nonprofits. Check with a financial advisor to see if it is a good time for you to make a gift. Your support keeps People Powered Radio strong and ensures a bright future for KAXE. We'd love for you to write into our text line. The number is 218-326-1234. Thanks to the folks that are coming forward during this news match time. We've been hearing from lots of people who are donating that they have seen a difference in the community by having local news. We want to thank Joe, who was pledging in honor of his mom. Joe's from Richfield, recently lost his mom, and says, "I love most about her presence in the world was the way she built joyful community wherever we went." That is Lucy McCommon Marty. And thank you, Joe, for making that donation on her behalf. More news is next. It's a minute after 6 o'clock.
NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump announced last night that he has signed a bill compelling the Justice Department to release its case files on the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. NPR Stephen Fowler reports on what comes next.
Within 30 days, the Attorney General is supposed to make documents available that relate to Epstein as well as his accomplice Ghislaine Maxwell. That includes travel records, individuals named or referenced in connection with Epstein's criminal activities, information about plea deals and decisions not to charge Epstein, and his death by suicide. But some things won't be made public, like pictures and videos of Epstein's victims, and anything that's determined to jeopardize a federal investigation could be redacted too, which is relevant since Trump has called for investigating Democrats that have been mentioned in files related to Epstein. Stephen Fowler, NPR News.
A federal judge has resumed his probe. He wants to know who in the Trump administration ignored his order last spring to turn back planes carrying Venezuelan migrants to Central America. NPR's Adrian Florido reports Judge James Boasberg's contempt inquiry could lead to criminal prosecution.
Boasberg of the Federal District Court for D.C. had put his criminal contempt inquiry on hold while the Trump administration filed appeals. After an appeals court gave him the green light, he says he could start calling government officials to testify as soon as December 1st. Earlier this year, Boasberg ruled that the Trump administration had purposely defied an order he issued during an emergency hearing in March that it turned back planes carrying Venezuelans to a prison in El Salvador. He said he would find out who had ignored that order and hold them accountable. He has said he could go as far as appointing a special prosecutor to pursue criminal charges. Adrian Florido, NPR News.
A wave of Israeli airstrikes on Gaza last night killed more than 30 people, most of them women and children. That's according to Gaza's health ministry. Around 80 other people were wounded. NPR's Aya Batraoui reports this marks one of the deadliest nights in Gaza since the start of the shaky ceasefire last month.
Israel's military says gunmen opened fire at its forces in an area of southern Gaza still occupied by soldiers. Although the military says no soldiers were wounded, it launched deadly airstrikes targeting homes and shelters in north and south Gaza. Hamas says it rejects Israel's claims that its forces were fired upon, calling it a, quote, flimsy and transparent attempt at justifying its bombardment. Gaza civil defense spokesperson Mahmoud Bassal says a family of five was killed in one attack. In a video from last night, he's seen carrying the lifeless body of a young girl with pigtails covered in debris from that family. When will these scenes in Gaza end? When will the killing of our children stop, he says. Aya Batraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
The White House says President Trump will meet with former Israeli hostages and their families today. The meeting will be held at the White House this afternoon. You're listening to NPR. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says new cases of botulism have been found in babies. 31 babies have been sickened and all were hospitalized. No deaths are reported. The illnesses have been associated with a baby formula produced by the company ByHeart. Officials at ByHeart have recalled all their products. In pre-market trading, Dow futures are booming. This comes after chip maker NVIDIA reported strong sales and earnings numbers. NPR's Maria Aspen reports NVIDIA says it made another $32 billion in profit in the latest quarter.
NVIDIA is the most valuable company in the world. It sells the semiconductors that are powering the AI boom, and it's making gobs of money. But for all the billions of dollars that tech companies are investing in AI, they're not seeing a lot of payoff yet. Now more top investors and CEOs are warning that the AI bubble is due to burst. That's a problem for the stock market, which has been hitting records record highs thanks to tech stocks, despite lots of other economic uncertainty. Tariffs are cutting into company profits, consumer prices are rising, and the jobs market is weakening. Investors will get a delayed government update on employment, but in the meantime, they celebrated NVIDIA's blockbuster report card. Maria Aspen, NPR News, New York.
One of Indonesia's volcanoes is erupting. Hundreds of people have been evacuated away from Mount Semeru on the island of Java. Indonesian authorities had to rescue more than 170 mountain climbers. They were stranded by the eruption. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Bayer. Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. This is NPR.
I found a song.
So I found KAXE when I was in college here in Bemidji. I actually can remember being at the stoplights at Dave's Pizza, just jumping radio stations, and it must have been, I want to say it was the Jayhawks, maybe Wilco was on the radio, and it floored me. As like, wait, how am I hearing this in Bemidji, in northern Minnesota? I thought I had to be in the Twin Cities to get this stuff.
Mark is a member of KAXE. We are people powered. The music that you hear is not chosen by the government or an algorithm or a corporation. It's chosen by your friends and neighbors. Over 70 hours a week is produced by local volunteers. Support the people of northern Minnesota and KAXE with your donation now. Go to KAXE.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And Amy Martinez in Culver City, California. Former FBI Director James Comey was back in federal court yesterday.
Yeah, Comey faces false statements and obstruction charges tied to congressional testimony he gave in 2020. But the Trump Justice Department's case against him is running into core legal challenges that could leave it on shaky ground.
NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas joins us. Ryan, you were there for this hearing yesterday where there was a bit of legal drama happening.
There sure was. There was quite a bit of it. And really, the big news to come out of the hearing revolves around the indictment in this case. The new acting U.S. Attorney Lindsey Halligan presented this case to a grand jury. She did so at the end of September. And Halligan initially sought three counts against Comey, but the grand jury rejected one of those. So in the end, Comey was indicted on two counts, the ones that were mentioned at the top, false statements and obstruction. But there have been questions about what exactly happened in the grand jury process. And in a remarkable exchange in court yesterday, prosecutors told the judge that the full grand jury never reviewed the final indictment against Comey. Halligan herself was questioned by the judge. She acknowledged that only the foreperson and one other grand juror saw it. The government described this as little more than a paperwork error. Comey's attorney disagreed. He said this means there is no indictment and said that this is grounds to have this case dismissed.
So a full grand jury not seeing a final indictment. That sounds like a serious issue.
Well, look, I spoke with a couple of former federal prosecutors yesterday who said this is really a self-inflicted wound by the government. They said that this is prosecutor 101 level stuff and it just shouldn't happen. The judge certainly sounded concerned. This raises questions about the validity of the indictment itself. Last night, the government filed another brief at the judge's request on this very issue. And prosecutors argued again that everything here was above board. It's all proper. The judge didn't say yesterday what he intends to do, but this clearly is not a positive development for the government. And it's not even the first time this week that there have been concerns raised about this investigation and the grand jury process itself. Just a couple of days ago, a magistrate judge took the unusual step of ordering the government to turn over all grand jury materials to Comey's defense team. That judge said there's a pattern of what he called profound investigative missteps in this case, and that those raise the prospect of prosecutorial misconduct that may have tainted the whole grand jury process. Now, the government is pushing back on the magistrate judge's findings and says that they shouldn't have to turn over these grand jury materials.
Now, I'm sure there are some next steps left.
That's right. Remarkably that, you know, there are all of these various legal challenges, but the amazing thing is that yesterday's hearing was actually centered on a different legal challenge that Comey is making. And that's that this case against him is one of vindictive prosecution, that Trump here is using the Justice Department to go after a high-profile critic. Comey's attorney, Michael Dreeben, pointed to a social media post by President Trump just days before Comey was indicted, demanding that the Justice Department prosecute him. Dreeben told the judge that the record here is, quote-unquote, crystal clear. The Justice Department, for its part, says no, Halligan is not a puppet. Prosecutors say she acted independently. It is worth remembering, though, that Halligan is a former White House aide with no prosecutorial experience who was appointed days before she secured this indictment. Now, the judge didn't rule from the bench yesterday, so we are waiting for a ruling on the vindictive prosecution question and on a separate motion challenging the legality of Halligan's appointment. So, look, there are a number of serious legal challenges that the government is going to have to overcome before this case gets to trial.
NPR's Ryan Lucas. Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you.
For more on the future of the government's case against Comey, let's go to Eli Honig. He's a former federal prosecutor and author of the book When You Come at the King, Inside DOJ's Pursuit of the President from Nixon to Trump. Eli, thank you for being back on the program.
Always happy to be with you, Layla. Thanks.
So as a former prosecutor, what are your thoughts on the government's missteps here?
Well, there are a lot of them, and I think I would group them into two categories. The first one being just sheer competence, or as the case may be, incompetence. And yesterday's hearing, I think, shows us one example of that, this failure to have the full grand jury vote on the revised indictment. The second category, I think, I would put under the category of bad motives, bad intent, and that would go to the selective and vindictive prosecution argument, which was also on the table yesterday. And it's important to note, with all these different motions to dismiss that are on the table right now, all James Comey's defense team has to do is win on any one of them, and the case gets dismissed. So it does feel to me like this case is really coming apart at the seams.
Do you find the selective and vindictive argument persuasive?
I do. I mean, it's important to understand those arguments do get raised by defendants quite frequently, and they almost never succeed. The bar is really high. You have to show as a defendant either that you are being prosecuted solely because of personal animus, because somebody in the government, maybe the prosecutor, maybe the president, just despises you and wants to do this for that reason. And then for selective prosecution, you have to show that among other people who did similar things, you are being selected, chosen for political purposes because of your political speech. Now, people do raise those claims, but they always lose. But the reason I think Comey may not lose and has really the strongest case for selective or vindictive prosecution is because Trump has said it all out loud. You have, of course, the September 20th social media post by Donald Trump ordering Pam Bondi to go after not just Jim Comey, but also Letitia James, other Democrats, Adam Schiff. If you look at Jim Comey's motion, he actually attaches a 59-page attachment listing out all of the public attacks by Trump on Comey and by Comey on Trump. So rarely do you have this developed a record of bad blood between the two parties. So I think Comey's got a real shot on that one.
Now, as you mentioned, there are several missteps by the government, including the full grand jury not seeing the indictment. Yep. How unusual is it in a high-profile case like this one to have this many missteps?
Well, it's unusual in a high, medium, or low profile case. It's important to understand who Lindsay Halligan is, that she may be an intelligent person. She may be a good lawyer. I don't really know. Let's give her the benefit of the doubt. But she's not a competent prosecutor. Her fourth day on the job, when she got appointed back in September, that is when she indicted this case. She went into a grand jury, her fourth day on the job. She started on a Monday, this was a Thursday, and tried to get this indictment in a case. I will tell you, if I went into a grand jury on my fourth day on the job and tried to indict a complicated high-stakes case like this too, I'm sure I would have screwed up as well. And let's just understand what we learned yesterday. So Halligan goes into the grand jury with a three-count indictment. The grand jury rejects count one and accepts count two and three. Mm-hmm. She then, or somebody then, creates a new indictment. Now, important to know, she did not fabricate or add language or add charges. She just took out count one, which had been rejected, and basically renumbered the two counts that had been approved. However, any semi-experienced prosecutor would know, let's be safe, bring it back to the grand jury, say, okay, folks, this is a new indictment. It reflects the count. It got rid of the count you rejected. and take a vote. It would take 10 minutes. Instead, she just brings it to the judge with two grand jurors with her, which is not enough. And now she's created this problem for herself out of a sheer lack of competence.
Now, the DOJ filed this case just before the statute of limitations on the alleged crime expired. So if the judge were to dismiss it, would the DOJ be able to recalibrate and then bring it again?
So that's a really important point, and the answer is no. Ordinarily, if a judge dismisses on technical grounds, it will be dismissed what we call without prejudice, meaning, okay, we should have brought this new revised indictment back to the grand jury. The judge will dismiss, and then you go and do that, and then you're fine. You're back in business. Here, however, the statute of limitations, the five-year window that you have to charge a case, ran out on September 30th of this year. That's why there was such a mad rush, by the way, on Donald Trump's behalf to get Jim Comey indicted, because the testimony that they're saying he gave to Congress that was false was September 30th of 2020. So if this case gets thrown out now, they're out of time. They cannot go back and reindict it.
Former federal prosecutor Ellie Honig, thank you so much for your time and your insights.
Thanks for having me.
The Supreme Court may soon issue a decision influencing a new wave of congressional redistricting. Exactly when the court rules could have big implications for the gerrymandering fight ahead of next year's midterm elections. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang explains.
Some states are watching to see what happens to the Voting Rights Act.
We will hear argument first this morning in case 24-109, Louisiana versus Calais.
After the Supreme Court held a rare second hearing last month for a Louisiana redistricting case, the court's conservative majority appears inclined to weaken the Voting Rights Act's protections against maps that dilute the power of racial minorities. That could lead to Republican-led states, particularly in the South, undoing districts where black voters have a realistic opportunity of electing their preferred candidates, or usually Democrats.
The situation we find ourselves is not typical.
Louisiana State Representative Beau Boyer, a Republican, led the push to delay the state's primary election by a month. And in Alabama, a Republican lawmaker is proposing to allow for a special primary. It's all to give their states more time to redistrict for next year's midterms in case the Supreme Court ruling comes earlier than usual.
It's not unreasonable to think the Supreme Court might issue an opinion before the typical June.
So a decision, you know, in June gives little or no time to most states, whereas a decision this fall would give a lot more time to quite a few states to redistrict.
Nick Stephanopoulos, an election law professor at Harvard University, says that's because redistricting maps have to be finalized before a state's filing deadline for candidates running in the primary. For most states, those deadlines are still months away.
I think a January decision likely opens the door to the decimation of minority representation in Louisiana and Alabama and South Carolina and Tennessee and other places too.
But Michael Lee at the Brennan Center for Justice says there's a possible complication to keep in mind. If the Supreme Court does weaken the current redistricting requirements under the Voting Rights Act, Section 2, not every Republican-led state may try to redo their congressional maps before the midterms.
There are many places in the country where getting rid of Section 2 districts would make neighboring Republican districts much more competitive, and that may not be what Republicans want.
Lee says after the Supreme Court rules, state lawmakers will have to weigh their next steps in this ongoing gerrymandering fight over control of the House of Representatives. Hansi Lo Wang, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It is 6:19. Thanks for tuning in. This has been Morning Edition from National Public Radio. I'm Heidi Holton. This is People Powered, KAXE. We sure appreciate you tuning in today. And coming up, we're going to be talking fishing. We're in that in-between time. Lakes aren't frozen yet. Ice fishing is on the horizon. What are you seeing where you live? You can text us at 218-326-1234. Let's take a look at the weather. Patchy fog and drizzle this morning. Cloudy skies, highs 39 to 42. Northwest winds from 5 to 10, could gust up to 20. Overnight tonight, we're looking at partly cloudy skies, lows 22 to 26 degrees. And tomorrow, Friday, sunny with highs 35 to 41. Evening temperatures in the low to mid-20s. And by Saturday, partly sunny, highs 42 to 48 degrees. This is the Change in Season Time. Our new Season Watch pod explores nature as the seasons change. That'll be coming out later today. We want to know from you, how do you change when fall turns to winter? Are you baking bread? Are you getting the sweaters out? You can text us 218-326-1234. Coming up, we'll be telling you more about Give to the Max Day. That is the big day in Minnesota to support nonprofits that mean something to you. And we want to thank you and everyone who has donated so far during our Newsmatch campaign. The early support has really made a difference, and it's helped us unlock matching dollars to bring you more local news and storytelling across northern Minnesota. Now, for Give to the Max Day, we are excited to share with you that the McKnight Foundation has added an extra $9,000 in matching funds. That means your gift is now matched 4-1 on right now. You can go to kaxe.org to give. Thank you so much for supporting people-powered KAXE. Support this morning comes from our local business supporters, and that includes Sanford Health with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Coming up, Jeff Sundin.
Gone fishing. Babble, 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 babble. There's a sign upon your door.
Pops, don't blabbing around, will you?
Gone fishing.
Keep it shady. I got me a big one staked out.
You ain't working anymore.
I don't have to work. I got me a piece of Gary.
Cows need milking in the barn.
I have the twins on that detail. They each take a side.
But you just don't give a darn.
Give them 4 bits of cow and hand lotion.
You just never seem to learn.
Man, you taught me.
You ain't got no ambition.
You're convincing.
Gone fishing. Got your hound dog by your side.
That's old Cindy Lou going with me.
Gone fishing.
Mm-hmm.
Fleas are biting at his hide.
Get away from me, boy, you bother me. Folks won't find us now because Mr. Satch and Mr. Cross, we gone fishing. Instead of just a wishing,
bapa, baby, bapa, bapa,
oh,
yeah.
Time to talk fishing on the Thursday morning show. I'm Heidi Holton. Joining me now, our early bird fishing guide, Jeff Sundin. Jeff, thanks for being here.
Good morning. You're welcome.
So last week you were away and we got some interesting information. I left you a message about some brothers, and hopefully their cheeks are burning right now, that have a ritual of listening to you every single Thursday morning, and they were a little worried about you last week.
Well, I apologize for not being there. I got my first ever panoptics. We were making a joke about this because I have cataracts in my eyes. Apparently something special. They came on kind of quick and got bad faster than most of the time happens. But anyway, when I was signing the paperwork, they called them panoptics, which happens to be one of the brand items of the forward-facing sonar. So I put a little teaser on the Facebook page, and a few people fell for it. They thought that I actually went out and bought the forward sonar, but instead I just got a new eyeball. I got my first one last week, and then we were back down in the cities again yesterday for a quick checkup, and they said that everything looks okay on that one. So then I go back again, and I'm going to do the next one Monday. So by next Thursday, I won't have to interrupt the schedule. I'll be back.
There we go.
Back in the office.
Well, and we'll all be off. It's Thanksgiving next Thursday, so you'll get time.
Is that?
Yeah, it is already.
Can you believe it?
No, So Jeff, are you telling us that you have forward-facing sonar in your eyeballs now?
Yep, that's what it is. Okay. I can hardly wait to look at it's after a week, it's just starting to settle in. I'm realizing now how cool it is to be able to see things. So I'm really looking forward to being able to look at my old-fashioned Fred Flintstone flasher for ice fishing and see what see if it looks a lot different. And, you know, I've been looking, maybe somebody's listening and will hear this. I'm trying to find an old, like the kind of flashers that we all used 30, 40 years ago, whether it's a Lowrance or a Hummingbird, or it doesn't make any difference to me, the brand of it, but I need a complete one that I can install on the boat. I've got a special project that I have in mind for it this coming summer. And I need to figure out some that's got, I can find the control heads for them pretty easy, but getting the transducer and all the mounting stuff, a lot of people, when they get rid of their boats, they never pull those transducers off and they just disappear. So you never know. Somebody might hear that and say, yeah. Hey, I got one of those.
Yeah, you don't.
Give you a few bucks for it. Right, there we go. So yeah. Anyway, that's where we're at now.
Okay. And if folks have them, you can text us at 218-326-1234. Okay, so it's almost Thanksgiving, so that means we're starting to think, you're starting to think about the ice fishing season. What are you thinking? What are you seeing?
Well, we drove on our way back yesterday. We got out of town just early enough to see some of the lakes coming up. For some reason, I decided I wanted to drive up 65, so you don't see a ton of lakes as you get further north, but even down further south on 65, we were noticing some of the lakes have got some skim ice around the edges of them and the small ponds. The rivers that don't have a lot of current flow have got a little bit of ice covering on them. So, and then I got on and checked some webcams and did some research on the internet to see who was talking about ice in their neck of the woods. Red Lake, some of the bigger lakes, we've had so much wind, so it can get a little ice around the edges, but you need calm and cold at the same time for the lake to skim over and run across. Ordinarily, by now, you'd see some couple of pictures of something larger scale, like Red Lake or one of the shallower duck ponds or something like that that skimmed over. It's a little bit early for that. So far, there's just enough ice to make it pretty hard to put a boat on the lake and not enough ice to be able to walk out or do anything like that. So right now, there's literally a time, maybe it's going to last another 10, 12 days, where there isn't going to be anything going on at all. But Susan was reading me off the forecast for next week, and it looks like it's going to get pretty chilly for a little while. After Thanksgiving, maybe, and as we go into that period, everything is going to really start breaking loose. I think you'll probably see some folks. I want to make too solid of a prediction, but I think within the next 2 weeks, you'll see some folks starting to gather on the shoreline up at Red Lake. That's anymore. That's like a badge of honor to be the first one to put a picture of yourself doing something dumb. You want to be on social media as the first person out on Red Lake catching a walleye, even if it means that somebody's going to have to come and rescue you later. But whether you like it or not, it's going to happen. So I think a couple weeks until you'll see some of that going on. And then probably, I'm going to say maybe December 10th or so before you'll start to see anything get really super serious around here. The folks that like to dark house spear for northerns, they always get out on the shallow flowages, the outer extremes of Whinny and some of the larger lakes, but the back bays, they'll freeze up. And there's usually something going on by about December 1st, give or take, in that neck of the woods. So I would anticipate seeing some movement in that direction. Mostly what I notice now, since nobody can really fish, everybody is talking about all the gizmos and gadgets and proposed regulations and things like that. I'm seeing a lot of chatter, and there's some stuff in the hopper. Next week, or 2 weeks from now, I guess that'll be plenty of time. We'll have some news about some new bills that seem like they're going to be introduced here before too long. And I don't want to jump the gun, but keep your ears open, because I'll have some new information to share about legislation that's getting thrown into the mix here for the next season or two. So we'll have plenty of time to talk about that.
Let's talk
right now.
Yeah, let's talk about ice fishing and some new regulations that may be out there.
The most interesting one right now, Minnesota has decided to allow the use of automatic hook setting devices, which is basically a cradle or a device. You still use a fishing rod, take your favorite 30 or 28, 36 inch ice fishing rod with you, and you put the handle of the rod in a holder. And then you bend the rod over down to the about to the tip of the ice, and you fasten that to an attachment that holds the rod in place. When a fish comes along and picks up your lure, it trips that trigger, that attachment to the tip of your rod, and the rod springs up. And as it springs up, it sets the hook for you. So folks are familiar with fishing with a tip up, where you see the flag go up. You still have to run over, and you have to figure out if the fish is still on the line and pull on it and set the hook yourself. So what this would get rid of is that quick scurry over to the hole to see if the fish is there or not. It would just sort of set the hook for you as it goes. Now, it sounds, on paper, it sounds like a really good, easy idea, but the first thing Susan was talking about last night, we were kind of getting ready for today and talking about that a little bit, and she said, what about all those times when the little sunfish come and steal your bait, or the little perch come and nip at your minnow or whatever, and it sounds like there's going to be quite a few folks that are going to be chasing that rod when it flips up, because it thinks it set the hook, but just because it's automatic doesn't mean it's better at setting the hook than we are. And so I think there's going to be a lot of fish that get missed by it, which is okay. It's going to be kind of fun to watch sometimes. It's not going to hurt anything, because the pro side of this, what would be good about it is that less fish will be hooked down in the gullet. There's less reaction time, and so folk will have probably a lower likelihood of hooking fish deep in the stomach and having to figure out how to get the hooks out, make for a little bit more effective catch and release fishing. So that part of it should be good. It'll be interesting to see. I without sounding like I'm putting on a sales pitch for them, I went and did a little bit of looking around, and it's not going to take. If you just Google automatic hook setting gizmos, it's going to be very, very easy to find them. I put a picture, I've got a little article about it yesterday in the DNR news release about it, and I included a picture, but not intending that that's the only device that you can buy. So I didn't name the brand or the model or anything like that. You just do a Google search, decide for yourself which one of them looks like it'll fill the bill, and if you want to give one a try, it's not going to cost a bunch of money, $50 or so, maybe a little less for some of them. So you can run out there and give it a try. We'll probably pick one up and try it just to see if it does help, you know, especially I could see some applications, northern pike fishing, or, you know, fishing for crappies when you like to, you're allowed to have two rods. And it sounds like a piece of cake to fish with two lines when you're ice fishing, but anytime things get busy, it can be a little bit hard to manage. So it wouldn't be the worst idea to fish with a traditional jigging lure or something like that in one hole. And then in the old days when you used to use a bobber or a set line to try and keep a separate maybe a plane hook with a minnow or something like that going, and then kind of keep your eyes on both of them at the same time. This would allow you to do that, and that second line, you have a little bit more chance of being able to actually hook a fish once in a while. So I can see where this is going to kind of be kind of fun to try out, and we'll probably have some reports on that as the winter goes along too.
Jeff, we're already getting a little low on time, so I'll leave it up to you what you want to mention before we go.
Well, let's do a quick, since we're on the subject of ice fishing, Red Lake does have a new regulation for the winter. You'll be allowed to keep four walleyes. Only one walleye can be over 17 inches, so just keep that in the back of your mind. And that's not per day, that's in possession. So if you're up there in a wheelhouse or something like that, once you do harvest a fish over 17, that's the end of that. So don't take a new one every day, because that'll put you over the top when it comes to violations. And then I guess since we're getting close and Christmas is just around the corner, ordinarily this would be a little early to talk about things for Christmas gifts, but one idea that popped into my head here for especially people have got young grandkids or kids, or if you've got somebody, a favorite person in your life who's just turned 51, let's say, I think it wouldn't be the worst idea to think about giving somebody a lifetime fishing license. Because for that, 51 and over, $379, fishing license for the rest of their life, that's a pretty good deal. And if you got a kid under three, it's $344. Not bad. Good value for somebody that, you know, especially when you want to encourage somebody. Sometimes the only reason folks don't get out and go fishing, I don't have a license, I don't want to stop, I don't want to go through the trouble. Well, if it's already in your pocket anyway, you can kind of go whenever you want to. Kind of helps keep some people in the idea. And then the simplest of the simple, I experienced this myself on the deer hunting opener. I never used them before, but I picked up a few packages of these little peel and stick toe warmers. Mm. Kind of, you know, everybody's used the hand warmers that you put in your gloves. But for a couple bucks, I put those toe warmers. They stick to your socks and they don't come off. They stay there all day. And my feet were roaster toasty warm the entire time. I never, for a couple of dollars, I'd throw a few of those in. In fact, that's probably what our family's going to get this year. Everybody's going to get a couple of those. And if they don't like them, they can give them to me and I'll use them.
You can also, people been, it's pretty expensive, but I know some people that have gotten some of those jackets that are, they've got heaters built into them too.
Susan got me one of those as a gift a few years ago, and it comes in pretty handy. I like it. Like you're saying, it's a little bit more expensive, but that's not a bad idea. Maybe we'll talk about that again. Before we go, I should mention, I just happened to be noticing, because I was looking at one of my other favorite things to do is to check out what's going on at the Fishing Hall of Fame, and I noticed they had a thing about Give to the Max Day is today,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
It
and
is.
They're encouraging folks. So, and you know us, we're now... We're not rich people, Susan and I, but we support we listen to the radio, I talk to you, we like it that it's available. So if you use these things, you know, throw a few bucks in the pot, but you know, kind of put your money where your mouth is, so to speak. So
yeah, that's right. It is Give to the Max Day, givemn.org. We recommend you support the things that matter to you in northern Minnesota. We'd love to hear all morning. Jeff just mentioned the Minnesota Fishing Hall of Fame. What places you might be supporting, you can text us 218-326-1234. Thanks to everyone who supports KEXE, including you and Susan. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you. See ya.
See ya. Coming up, we've got National Native News. This is the Thursday morning show. It's People Powered KAXE. We're going to be hearing about how for decades, starting in 1907, Indigenous women and women of color across the country were sterilized without their informed consent. KUNM's Jeanette Didois has more on this story. Make sure you stay tuned for it. Weather around our region, patchy fog and drizzle early this morning. Cloudy skies, highs 39 to 42. Northwest winds 5 to 10, could gust up to 20 miles an hour.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bowles, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. For decades, starting in 1907, indigenous women and women of color across the country were sterilized without their informed consent. Last week, a coalition of women's reproductive rights advocates called on New Mexico legislators to create a commission to investigate the abuses. KUNM's Jeanette DeDios has more.
Numerous reports show sterilizations peaked in the 1960s through the late 70s. That's when upwards of 70,000 Indigenous women were forced or coerced into sterilization procedures by the Indian Health Service and contracted physicians, including those at the University of New Mexico. By the mid-1970s, at least 25% of Indigenous women of childbearing age had been sterilized. Executive Director of Indigenous Women Rising, Rachel Lorenzo from the Mescalero Apache in Laguna Pueblo, says she was a target of coercion.
Doctors refused to take out my IUD, despite the fact the copper IUD, which is called Paragard, made me bleed for 10 months, and four different doctors refused to take it out because it was working the way it was supposed to. And they said I was too young at 22 to have another baby.
The proposed joint memorial would establish a memorial to victims, but also a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that would make New Mexico the first U.S. state to formally investigate and acknowledge the violations done to Indigenous women. Democratic State Senator Linda Lopez agreed that the legislature needs to acknowledge the role New Mexico played in this history.
It wasn't us who are here in the roundhouse at this point in time. And yes, it was maybe another governmental entity, but Madam Chair, I think those of us who are elected have a responsibility to say this should never have happened, this will not happen, and that we apologize.
Democratic State Representative Michelle Paulina Beta says there also needs to be more resources for educating youth about reproductive care. New Mexico currently doesn't have a law on forced sterilization. For National Native News, I'm Jeanette DeDios.
The Native vote was center stage Tuesday morning at the National Congress of American Indians Annual Convention in Seattle. Panelists discussed various barriers facing Native voters in efforts to protect Native voting rights. Matthew Campbell, deputy director at the Native American Rights Fund, was on the panel. He says the states of the Native votes across the country has its ups and downs.
Typically, a voter might choose to only vote in the presidential election every 4 years. But I think it's really critical to remember that if we elect candidates of our choice in the state legislature, for the school boards, you know, every single race really can make a difference in our lives. If we elect people that lift up and fight for tribal sovereignty at the state level, that's really important. And if we elect people that are aware about our culture and our tradition at the school board level, that's also really important.
Janie Parrish is the executive director of Arizona Native Vote. She says work on Native voting issues takes place year-round and not just during big election years like presidential or midterms.
Like many issues, whether it's tribal sovereignty, climate, education, there are people constantly working on these issues, whether that's on an advocacy side or lobbying or policy. It's the same thing with civic engagement and voting and elections.
Parrish is a panelist on civic engagement in Indian Country Wednesday afternoon. Voting is just one of the many issues attendees of the NCEI Annual Convention are focusing on. Organizers say this year's convention is seeing record numbers, with 2,500 people registered. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios of Eugene, Oregon.
National Native News is produced.
We thank National Native News for their great reporting that we bring to you through National Native News. It's Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, and you hear it weekday mornings at this time. They're funded in part by people like you, as well as the Annenberg Foundation and the Ford Foundation. It's 6:44. I'm joined now by Kari Hedlund. It's Thursday morning.
It is Thursday morning, and I'm feeling ready for it to be a Thursday.
It's Thanksgiving week ahead next week, and the weather is shifting, as we just heard Heidi and Jeff talking about the shift, and especially after Thanksgiving, what that means. So our question of the week this week ties into that, and it's talking about, what do you do to prepare for the winter? You know, Jennifer talked about getting different shoes by the door. It's no longer like the slip-on sandals. It's the...
I kind of got in trouble for wearing shoes in the house, because in the fall, I don't worry as much about, I always take them off immediately because there's not wet stuff and, you know. Yeah, so that was a sign of the change.
I know, but it's just, it's been so chilly here at the station. Mm-hmm. It's a weird thing that seems to happen every time we transition seasons. It's like one extreme or the other. I've been going home the last couple of days just like chilled to the bone because I've been cold all day, that I couldn't take my shoes off yesterday either because my feet were cold.
Yeah. You got to get those warmers and tape them to your feet like Jeff Sundin does.
I guess I do. That's the stage I'm at now.
So it's about prepping for being warmer is what you're telling us?
Yes. I mean, I've done the whole clothes transition.
Although you and I would notice today, I kind of thought to myself, I was a little cold yesterday. I could have worn a sweater.
Well, same. I'm wearing a short-sleeved button-up underneath this jacket.
Yeah, so I kind of
could have been smarter.
Same thing. I know.
Every day, I feel like I could have dressed smarter.
Fashion first here at KEXE, that's for sure.
Sure. That is a line that everybody says.
But we want to hear from you. I also know happen to know because I have eaten it. You are in bread making mode.
I am just kind of feeling. So I was thinking about this last night because I'm still just eking my way through this book. And we normally talk about books on Thursday. And this book I'm reading right now, I'm literally reading like three pages at a time. Like, it is going to be the longest read probably ever. Because I'm just so tired lately. And my brain is just in a making mode. Like, I want to make and create. And so I'm like, got a couple different projects going right now of things that I am making along with diving back into some bread baking.
Yeah. You sound like me. I'm making stuff too at home. I haven't been reading as much. I've been.
I wonder why that is.
Making, it's going to be more of a making kind of Christmas and a Christmas. I'm spending time trying to be more sustainable.
100% me too.
I find it more interesting, to be honest, let alone sustainable.
And we were having this discussion because both of us have been down this deep dive of thrifting, and we're not alone. I've been talking to lots of people locally, and you see it online. But it does something to the brain when you go in then to a regular store, which I think is good. I think the check in the brain has been really a good sort of rebalancing of what is needed.
You know, a couple weekends ago, I went to a neighboring town to thrift shop. Or I needed some other things too. So it was going to be kind of a mix of thrift and regular stores. And I was a little bossy, and I decided that we needed to thrift first, because otherwise we wouldn't have that in our head.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'd say, oh, wow, this is a good deal. Meaning, you know, a pair of gloves for $60 or something, you know, rather than. And so it actually turned out to be better than I could have engineered, because the first thrift place we went to had a sign that pointed down and said free. So there was a free basement.
Basement, not just a box.
Right. Before we went up to the regular part. So changed our brain the whole day.
Yeah.
On even things that were like $3. Like, really?
Gonna spend that?
Yeah. But it is a really interesting thing on what, I mean, especially I'm really enjoying, I donated a whole bunch of Christmas stuff, and now I'm kind of putting together some new old things, and it's fun to have a different sort of feel and look and get your house cozy. And, you know, I'm so mad I missed out on something I really wanted.
Oh, me too.
Went back the next day and it was gone. Maybe you bought it.
I found this thing on Marketplace, and it was something that I have been looking for our kitchen for months. And I waited for a response from my husband. I should have just like texted him, but I messaged, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
A day for me to get back to this person, and it was already sold. And I'm now because I've been scouring the internet for another island table workstation thing.
Sure.
I'm still just mad that I missed out on that.
But sometimes it does work to give it time.
I know.
Because it does go out of your head and you're like, yes, oh yeah, I didn't
need that. Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. So we'd love to hear from you. Maybe you're looking at the holidays ahead as a thrift miss as well. Maybe you've got some good deals you want to tell us about. It's fun. It's a way to not feel quite as brought down by the amount of plastic in the world.
Yes. Feels like you're giving new life
a little
to something.
Bit, yeah. I mean, still it's everywhere, but
I would also put a call out. I was just talking with a friend and saying that some Saturday we should go to some smaller towns around the area to find antique shops and flea markets and thrift shops. So if you have...
Notice you didn't say me you were talking to. I think you and I
we can
to
talk
this,
about
and
this
then we
now.
Could talk about our field trip.
Oh, a work trip.
Uh-huh.
I mean, right. Probably better do that.
Right.
So if you have suggestions, though, of places and... Well, I love a curated thrift shop. I do. I'm also talking about like the corner shop that's been there for 85 years mm-hmm. and there's stuff in there from 85 years ago.
Digging through.
And you're digging through it.
All that
I'm
stuff.
Down. Give me those suggestions if you're willing to share. Or is it like a blueberry patch where you're not willing to share that information?
It might be. We would love to hear from you. The person that I went thrift store shopping mm-hmm. with, one of the things we found in the free part was a old school red golf bag.
Oh.
Really cool looking. That was going to be an outdoor decoration
okay.
for this person.
But yep.
I have since learned that this vintage red golf bag has been smashed. The excitement of decorating it found mouse nests in the golf club covers in the bottom.
Well, that's kind of the problem with maybe
it's
some
be
free
outside,
stuff.
Though.
Right. Well, right. I mean, future home for other mice.
Yeah. It's also, I mean, there's also still a shopping thing that you got to tamp down of like not thinking about it too much, but I'm finding it very stress relieving to be looking for deals and looking for, it's a little bit, it's history too.
Yes.
You know what I mean? 100%. What people were interested in and all of that stuff.
Do you know what I found last weekend that I have been looking for a really long time? I am a very slow collector of things. Like I have ideas in my brain and I'm just going to wait until I find it. Like I told this woman at this thrift shop, like I've been looking for this for over a year, mm-hmm. but like I haven't gone to the point of like, I haven't looked online for it. Like I've just left it up to the thrifting gods to present itself to me.
Mm-hmm.
That's my favorite way of doing things.
It happens.
I found a sweater pin, which I have been looking for so long. Those ones that stick on both ends of the collar. You can use them on a collar and then it connects with a little delicate chain.
Right.
Truly. I've been looking every thrift shop I go to, every antique shop, and I finally found one.
Wow. Since we're divulging.
I'm so excited.
Here. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I got a tiny lamp that's in my bathroom. It's like the nightlight that is so adorable with a really cute, I had bought a, in hopes of finding a tiny lamp, I bought a lamp shade that I love.
No way. So tiny. You were looking for one.
Mm-hmm. So I was looking for the tiny lamp. Just yesterday, I got the lamp.
Oh, that's exciting. And it works.
Makes me feel very good, the light it gives off.
How cozy.
Yeah. $3.
I mean,
Kari,
come on.
Come on.
Come on.
I know.
What a deal.
We'd love to hear from you. It is a day of giving. It is a day of conversation, as always, here at KEXE. It is Give to the Max Day, if you haven't heard yet. We want to thank everyone who's donated so far during our Newsmatch campaign. The early dollars and support has really made a difference, and we've been able to unlock matching dollars to bring you more local news and storytelling across northern Minnesota. We're going to hear from reporter Larissa Donovan in about an hour, which she's been covering this week. We are truly grateful for you because now for Give to the Max Day, we're excited to share that the McKnight Foundation has added an extra $9,000 in matching funds. This means that your gift will be matched 4-1.
Wow.
You can give right now at kexe.org. Thank you for supporting people-powered KEXE and give to other nonprofits you care about by going to givemn.org.
You know, all these foundations showing up for us in a lot of ways, along with you, our listeners. So we feel it. We are so grateful. And there are lots of opportunities to give today throughout the state of Minnesota. Maybe you want to look at other opportunities to support Northern Minnesota nonprofits. Go to givemn.org.
Right. You can just enter in your town, your region, where you live, and find out about that. It is, we'd love to hear from you. What are you supporting? Text 218-326-1234. Coming up, we're going to hear about some local live music in our region.
We receive support from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984. Performing auto body and collision repair, as well as auto glass replacement. Dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at dalesautobodyinc.com.
Not going to lie, the drizzle this morning I was really wishing was a little bit colder, so it was snow.
Oh, wouldn't that have been nice? It was slippery yesterday in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Cloudy today, patchy fog and drizzle early, 39 to 42, northwest winds 5 to 10, gusting up to 20. Colder tonight, 22 to 26 degrees.
This is The Set List on KAXC, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are taking a look at four shows this week, November 20th through the 22nd, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday in Virginia, Walker, Nisswa, and Bemidji. Starting things off with the new Iron Range supergroup Rangers at Chair in downtown Virginia. The project is led by Keith Sokola and features Rich Mattson, Jermaine Gemberling, and many other Iron Range musicians. They just released their debut album, Ranger, mixing folk, Americana, and rock and roll, this Thursday, 7 p.m. in Virginia. The same day, Duluth-based jam band Salty Dog are heading to Walker and the Green Scene Market and Eatery at 8 p.m. Salty Dog are led by Jacob and Owen Mann, who grew up in the Walker area and play a funky mix of rock, blues, and folk. They released their latest album, Pepper, in 2024. Salty Dog, Thursday night in Walker. The Grassroots Concert Series continues Friday in Nisswa with the Weary Ramblers at the Journey Church. The Ramblers are a folk duo with mandolin, harmonica, fiddle, and tight harmonies. They will be celebrating the release of their brand new album, Driftwood. It's Weary Ramblers, Friday, 7 p.m. at the Grassroots Concert Series in Nisswa. Finally, singer-songwriter Cage Jamber is playing at Bemidji Brewing on Saturday at 5 p.m. Part of the brewery's Timber Tap series, every other Saturday this winter, Jamber released a pair of singles last year called Golden Life and Kerosene, showcasing his melodic and acoustic style. Saturday, 5 p.m. at Bemidji Brewing. If you have information on live music you'd like us to know about, email comments at kaxc.org. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
The set list. Thanks to Malachi Coons for that. Coming up, we're going to have local news with the Up North Report.
The Watermark Arts Center has their final poetry slam tonight that of the year. Not final, but just final of the year at Fozzie's Barbecue in Bemidji. The music starts at 6 o'clock with poetry at 7. Poets should prepare 3 original poems, each under 3 minutes. You can contact Watermark Arts Center to guarantee your spot. That is for tonight.
You know, a lot of libraries are facing cuts. It's a difficult time right now in the world, and people are finding ways to support their local libraries. In Bemidji, they're doing those read-ins and other things. The Grand Rapids Area Library Fund has been established at the Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation. The goal is to raise $300,000 by September 1st of 2026. The funds will be earmarked for the library's budget. Our news team continuing to follow cuts on libraries and what it means to ours and the operations of our local library. So you can check that out at KEXE.org.
And we'll be catching up with our news team next hour at about 7:45. We'll be talking with Larissa Donovan about some stories she's been working on. So be sure to stay tuned.
Coming up before 9 o'clock, we welcome back Aaron Brown. He's going to be talking about, he's got this mix of timely topics and personal stories. And that's what we want to talk to him about today, about how heat assistance and some of the predicaments, the moment that we're living in, that people are living through in terms of how you pay for your heat that you need and what his family has gone through in the past. We'll hear from him coming up before 9 o'clock. We're also going to be checking in. I think this is going to be good for the both of us here, Kari, about the stress of the holidays.
Right.
We've got a local woman who's coming in. She just recently met with a group of women to kind of work through some of this stuff. And it's complex. It's not just, you know, staying up all night.